You got kids? One of the little girls spoke up.
I do, Al said.
Terry said he's going to keep him. He don't have a dog, the boy said.
I don't know, Al said. I don't think my kids would like that. It belongs to them. It's just lost, Al said.
He drove on down the street. It was dark now, hard to see, and he began to panic again, cursing silently. He swore at what a weather vane he was, changing this way and that, one moment this, the next moment that. He saw the dog then. He understood he had been looking at it for a time. The dog moved slowly, nosing the grass along the fence. Al got out of the car, started across the lawn, crouching forward as he walked, calling,
Susie, Susie, Susie.
The dog stopped when she saw him. She raised her head. He sat down on his heels, reached out his arm, waiting. They looked at each other. She moved her tail in greeting. She lay down with her head between her front legs and regarded him. He waited. She got up. She went around the fence and out of sight. He sat there. He thought he didn't feel so bad, all things considered. The world was full of dogs. There were dogs and there were dogs. Some dogs he just couldn't do anything with. Why, honey? Dear Sir, I was so surprised to receive your letter asking about my son. How did you know I was here? I moved here years ago, right after it started to happen. No one knows who I am here, but I'm afraid all the same. Who I am afraid of is him. When I look at the paper, I shake my head in wonder. I read what they write about him, and I ask myself, is that man really my son? Is he really doing these things? He was a good boy, except for his outbursts and that he could not tell the truth. I can't give you any reasons. It started one summer over the 4th of July. He would have been about 15. Our cat Trudy disappeared and was gone all night and the next day. Mrs. Cooper, who lives behind us, came the next evening to tell me Trudy crawled into her backyard that afternoon to die. Trudy was cut up, she said, but she recognized Trudy. Mr. Cooper buried the remains. Cut up, I said. What do you mean, cut up? Mr. Cooper saw two boys in the field putting firecrackers in Trudy's ears and in her you-know-what. He tried to stop them, but they ran. Who would do such a thing? Did he see who it was? He didn't know the other boy, but one of them ran this way. Mr. Cooper thought it was your son. I shook my head. No, that's just not so. He wouldn't do a thing like that. He loved Trudy. Trudy has been in the family for years. No, it wasn't my son. That evening I told him about Trudy, and he acted surprised and shocked and said we should offer a reward. He typed something up and promised to post it at school. But just as he was going to his room that night, he said, "Don't take it too hard, Mom. She was old. In cat years, she was 65 or 70. She lived a long time." He went to work afternoons and Saturdays as a stock boy at Hartley's. A friend of mine who worked there, Betty Wilkes, told me about the job and said she would put in a word for him. I mentioned it to him that evening, and he said, "Good. Jobs for young people are hard to find." The night he was to draw his first check, I cooked his favorite supper and had everything on the table when he walked in. "Here's the man of the house," I said, hugging him. "I am so proud. How much did you draw, honey?"
$80, he said.
I was flabbergasted. "That's wonderful, honey. I just cannot believe it."
"I'm starved," he said. "Let's eat."
I was happy, but I couldn't understand it. It was more than I was making. When I did the laundry, I found the stub from Hartley's in his pocket. It was for $28. He said $80. Why didn't he just tell the truth? I couldn't understand. I would ask him, "Where did you go last night, honey?" "To the show," he would answer. Then I would find out he went to the school dance or spent the evening riding around with somebody in a car. I would think, what difference could it make? Why doesn't he just be truthful? There is no reason to lie to his mother. I remember once he was supposed to have gone on a field trip, so I asked him, "What did you see on the field trip, honey?" And he shrugged and said, "Land formations, volcanic rock, ash. They showed us where there used to be a big lake a million years ago. Now it's just a desert." He looked me in the eyes and went on talking. Then I got a note from the school the next day saying they wanted permission for a field trip. Could he have permission to go? Near the end of his senior year, he bought a car and was always gone. I was concerned about his grades, but he only laughed. You know he was an excellent student. You know that about him if you know anything. After that, he bought a shotgun and a hunting knife. I hated to see those things in the house, and I told him so. He laughed. He always had a laugh for you. He said he would keep the gun and the knife in the trunk of his car. He said they would be easier to get there anyway. One Saturday night, he did not come home. I worried myself into a terrible state. About 10 o'clock the next morning, he came in and asked me to cook him breakfast. He said he had worked up an appetite out hunting. He said he was sorry for being gone all night. He said they had driven a long way to get to this place. It sounded strange. He was nervous. "Where did you go?"
"Up to the Buenos. We got a few shots."
"Who did you go with, honey?"
"Fred."
"Fred?" He stared, and I didn't say anything else. On the Sunday right after, I tiptoed into his room for his car keys. He had promised to pick up some breakfast items on his way home from work the night before, and I thought he might have left the things in his car. I saw his new shoes sitting half under his bed and covered with mud and sand. He opened his eyes. "Honey, what happened to your shoes? Look at your shoes."
"I ran out of gas. I had to walk for gas."
He sat up.
"What do you care?"
"I am your mother." While he was in the shower, I took the keys and went out to his car. I opened the trunk. I didn't find the groceries. I saw the shotgun lying on a quilt and the knife, too, and I saw a shirt of his rolled in a ball, and I shook it out, and it was full of blood. It was wet. I dropped it. I closed the trunk and started back for the house, and I saw him watching at the window, and he opened the door.
"I forgot to tell you," he said. "I had a bad bloody nose. I don't know if that shirt can be washed. Throw it away."
He smiled. A few days later, I asked how he was getting along at work.
"Fine," he said.
He said he had gotten a raise. But I met Betty Wilkes on the street, and she said they were all sorry at Hartley's that he had quit. He was so well-liked, she said, Betty Wilkes. Two nights after that, I was in bed, but I couldn't sleep. I stared at the ceiling. I heard his car pull up out front, and I listened as he put the key in the lock, and he came through the kitchen and down the hall to his room, and he shut the door after him. I got up. I could see light under his door. I knocked and pushed on the door and said, "Would you like a hot cup of tea, honey? I can't sleep." He was bent over by the dresser and slammed a drawer and turned on me. "Get out," he screamed. "Get out of here. I'm sick of you spying," he screamed. I went to my room and cried myself to sleep. He broke my heart that night. The next morning, he was up and out before I could see him, but that was all right with me. From then on, I was going to treat him like a lodger unless he wanted to mend his ways. I was at my limit. He would have to apologize if he wanted us to be more than just strangers living together under the same roof. When I came in that evening, he had supper ready.
"How are you?" he said. He took my coat. "How was your day?"
I said I didn't sleep last night, honey. I promised myself I wouldn't bring it up, and I'm not trying to make you feel guilty, but I'm not used to being talked to like that by my son.
"I want to show you something," he said.
And he showed me this essay he was writing for his civics class. I believe it was on relations between the Congress and the Supreme Court. It was the paper that won a prize for him at graduation. I tried to read it, and then I decided this was the time. "Honey, I'd like to have a talk with you. It's hard to raise a child with things the way they are these days. It's especially hard for us, having no father in the house, no man to turn to when we need him. You are nearly grown now, but I am still responsible, and I feel I am entitled to some respect and consideration and have tried to be fair and honest with you. I want the truth, honey. That's all I've ever asked from you, the truth. Honey? I took a breath. Suppose you had a child who, when you asked him something, anything, where he's been or where he's going, what he's doing with his time, anything, he never once told you the truth. Who, if you asked him, is it raining outside, would answer, no, it is nice and sunny, and I guess laugh to himself and think you were too old or too stupid to see his clothes are wet. Why should he lie? You ask yourself. What does he gain? I don't understand. I keep asking myself why, but I don't have the answer. Why, honey? He didn't say anything. He kept staring. Then he moved over alongside me and said, I'll show you. Kneel is what I say. Kneel down is what I say, he said. That's the first reason why. I ran to my room and locked the door. He left that night. He took his things, what he wanted, and he left. Believe it or not, I never saw him again. I saw him at his graduation, but that was with a lot of people around. I sat in the audience and watched him get his diploma and a prize for his essay. Then I heard him give the speech, and then I clapped right along with the rest. I went home after that. I have never seen him again. Oh, sure, I have seen him on the TV, and I have seen his pictures in the paper. I found out he joined the Marines, and then I heard from someone he was out of the Marines and going to college back east. And then he married that girl and got himself in politics. I began to see his name in the paper. I found out his address and wrote to him. I wrote a letter every few months. There never was an answer. He ran for governor and was elected and was famous now. That's when I began to worry. I built up all these fears. I became afraid. I stopped writing him, of course, and then I hoped he would think I was dead. I moved here. I had them give me an unlisted number, and then I had to change my name. If you are a powerful man and want to find somebody, you can find them. It wouldn't be that hard. I should be so proud, but I am afraid. Last week I saw a car on the street with a man inside I know was watching me. I came straight back and locked the door. A few days ago the phone rang and rang. I was lying down. I picked up the receiver, but there was nothing there. I am old. I am his mother. I should be the proudest mother in all the land, but I am only afraid. Thank you for writing. I wanted someone to know. I am very ashamed. I also wanted to ask how you got my name and knew where to write. I have been praying no one knew. But you did. Why did you? Please tell me why. Yours truly. The Ducks. A wind came up that afternoon, bringing gusts of rain and sending the ducks up off the lake in black explosions, looking for the quiet potholes out in the timber. He was at the back of the house splitting firewood and saw the ducks cutting over the highway and dropping into the marsh behind the trees. He watched, groups of half a dozen, but mostly doubles, one bunch behind the other. Out over the lake, it was already dark and misty, and he could not see the other side where the mill was. He worked faster, driving the iron wedge down harder into the big dry chunks, splitting them so far down that the rotten ones flew apart. On his wife's clothesline, strung up between the two sugar pines, sheets and blankets popped shot-like in the wind. He made two trips and carried all the wood onto the porch before it started to rain. Supper's ready, she called from the kitchen. He went inside and washed up. They talked a little while they ate, mostly about the trip to Reno. 3 more days of work, then payday, then the weekend in Reno. After supper, he went out onto the porch and began sacking up his decoys. He stopped when she came out. She stood there in the doorway watching him. You going hunting again in the morning? He looked away from her and out toward the lake.
Look at the weather. I think it's going to be good in the morning.
Her sheets were snapping in the wind, and there was a blanket down on the ground. He nodded at it.
Your things are going to get wet.
They weren't dry anyway. They've been out there 2 days and they're not dry yet.
What's the matter? Don't you feel good? He said.
I feel all right. She went back into the kitchen and shut the door and looked at him through the window. I just hate to have you gone all the time. It seems like you're gone all the time, she said to the window. Her breath produced itself on the glass, then went away. When he came inside, he put the decoys in the corner and went to get his lunch pail. She was leaning against the cupboard, her hands on the edge of the draining board. He touched her hip, pinched her dress.
You wait till we get to Reno. We're going to have some fun, he said.
She nodded. It was hot in the kitchen, and there were little drops of sweat over her eyes. I'll get up when you come in and fix you some breakfast.
You sleep. I'd rather have you sleep.
He reached around behind her for his lunch pail. Kiss me bye, she said. He hugged her. She fastened her arms around his neck and held him. I love you. Be careful driving. She went to the kitchen window and watched him running, jumping over the puddles until he got to the pickup. She waved when he looked back from inside the cab. It was almost dark, and it was raining hard. She was sitting in a chair by the living room window, listening to the radio and the rain, when she saw the pickup lights turn into the drive. She got up quickly and hurried to the back door. He stood there in the doorway, and she touched his wet, rubbery coat with her fingers.
They told everybody to go home. The mill boss had a heart attack. He fell right down on the floor up in the mill and died.
You scared me. She took his lunch pail and shut the door. Who was it? Was it that foreman named Mel?
No, his name was Jack Granger. He was about 50 years old, I guess.
He walked over close to the oil stove and stood there warming his hands.
Jesus, it's so funny. He'd come through where I work and asked me how I was doing and probably wasn't gone 5 minutes when Bill Bessie come through and told me Jack Granger had just died right up in the mill.
He shook his head.
Just like that.
Don't think about it, she said and took his hands between hers and rubbed his fingers.
I'm not. Just one of them things, I guess. You never know.
The rain rushed against the house and slashed across the windows.
God, it's hot in here. There any beer? He said.
I think there's some left, she said, and followed him out to the kitchen. His hair was still wet, and she ran her fingers through it when he sat down. She opened a beer for him and poured some into a cup for herself. He sat drinking it in little sips, looking out the window toward the dark woods. He said,
One of the guys said he had a wife and 2 grown kids.
She said, That Granger man, that's a shame. It's nice to have you home, but I hate for something like that to happen.
That's what I told some of the boys. I said it's nice to get on to home, but Christ, I hate to have it like this.
He edged a little in the chair.
You know, I think most of the men would have gone ahead and worked. But some of the boys up in the mill said they wouldn't work, him laying there like that.
He finished off the beer and got up.
I'll tell you, I'm glad they didn't work, he said.
She said, I'm glad you didn't either. I had a really funny feeling when you left tonight. I was thinking about it, the funny feeling I had when I saw the lights.
He was just in the lunchroom last night telling jokes. Granger was a good boy, always laughing.
She nodded. I'll fix us something to eat if you'll eat something.
I'm not hungry, but I'll eat something, he said.
They sat in the living room and held hands and watched television.
I've never seen any of these programs before, he said.
She said, I don't much care about watching anymore. You can hardly get anything worth watching. Saturday and Sunday it's all right, but there's nothing weeknights. He stretched his legs and leaned back.
he said. I'm kind of tired. I think I'll go to bed,
she said. I think I'll take a bath and go to bed, too. She moved her fingers through his hair and dropped her hand and smoothed his neck. Maybe we'll have a little tonight. We never hardly get a chance to have a little. She touched her other hand to his thigh, leaned over and kissed him. What do you think about that?
That sounds all right, he said.
He got up and walked over to the window. Against the trees outside, he could see her reflection standing behind him and a little to the side.
Hon, why don't you go ahead and take your bath and we'll turn in, he said.
He stood there for a while longer, watching the rain beat against the window. He looked at his watch. If he were working, it would be the lunch hour now. He went into the bedroom and began getting undressed. In his shorts, he walked back into the living room and picked up a book off the floor. Best Loved Poems of the American People. He guessed it had come in the mail from the club she belonged to. He went through the house and turned off the lights. Then he went back into the bedroom. He got under the covers, put her pillow on top of his, and twisted the gooseneck lamp around so that the light fell on the pages. He opened the book to the middle and began to look at some of the poems. Then he laid the book on the bedstand and bent the lamp away toward the wall. He lit a cigarette. He put his arms behind his head and lay there smoking. He looked straight ahead at the wall. The lamplight picked up all of the tiny cracks and swells in the plaster. In a corner, up near the ceiling, there was a cobweb. He could hear the rain washing down off the roof. She stood up in the tub and began drying herself. When she noticed him watching, she smiled and draped the towel over her shoulder and made a little step in the tub and posed. How does it look?
All right, he said.
Okay, she said.
I thought you were still, you know, he said.
I am. She finished drying and dropped the towel on the floor beside the tub and stepped daintily onto it. The mirror beside her was steamy and the odor of her body carried to him. She turned around and reached up to a shelf for the box. Then she slipped into her belt and adjusted the white pad. She tried to look at him. She tried to smile. He crushed out the cigarette and picked up the book again. What are you reading? She called.
I don't know. Crap, he said.
He turned to the back of the book and began looking through the biographies. She turned off the light and came out of the bathroom brushing her hair. You still going in the morning? She said.
Guess not, he said.
She said, I'm glad. We'll sleep in late, then get up and have a big breakfast. He reached over and got another cigarette. She put the brush in a drawer, opened another drawer, and took out a nightgown. Do you remember when you got me this? She said. He looked at her in reply. She came around to his side of the bed. They lay quietly for a time, smoking his cigarette until he nodded he was finished, and then she put it out. He reached over her, kissed her on the shoulder, and switched off the light.
You know, he said, lying back down, I think I want to get out of here. Go someplace else.
She moved over to him and put her leg between his. They lay on their sides facing each other, lips almost touching. He wondered if his breath smelled as clean as hers. He said,
I just want to leave. We've been here a long time. I'd like to go back home and see my folks. Or maybe go on up to Oregon. That's good country.
If that's what you want, she said.
I think so, he said. There's a lot of places to go.
She moved a little and took his hand and put it on her breast. Then she opened her mouth and kissed him, pulling his head down with her other hand. Slowly, she inched up in the bed, gently moving his head down to her breast. He took the nipple and began working it in his mouth. He tried to think how much he loved her, or if he loved her. He could hear her breathing, but he could also hear the rain. They lay like this. she said. If you don't want to, it's all right.
It's not that, he said,
not knowing what he meant. He let her go when he could tell she was asleep and turned over to his own side. He tried to think of Reno. He tried to think of the slots and the way the dice clicked and how they looked turning over under the lights. He tried to hear the sound the roulette ball made as it skimmed around the gleaming wheel. He tried to concentrate on the wheel. He looked and looked and listened and heard the saws and the machinery slowing down, coming to a stop. He got out of bed and went to the window. It was black outside and he could see nothing, not even the rain. But he could hear it, cascading off the roof and into a puddle under the window. He could hear it all over the house. He ran his finger across the drool on the glass. When he got back into bed, he moved close to her and put his hand on her hip. "Hun, wake up," he whispered. But she only shuddered and moved over farther to her own side. She kept on sleeping. "Wake up," he whispered. "I hear something outside." How about this? All the optimism that had colored his flight from the city was gone now, had vanished the evening of the first day as they drove north through the dark stands of redwood. Now the rolling pasture land, the cows, the isolated farmhouses of western Washington seemed to hold out nothing for him, nothing he really wanted. He had expected something different. He drove on and on with a rising sense of hopelessness and outrage. He kept the car at 50, all that the road allowed. Sweat stood on his forehead and over his upper lip, and there was a sharp, heady odor of clover in the air all around them. The land began to change. The highway dipped suddenly, crossed a culvert, rose again, and then the asphalt ran out and he was holding the car on a country dirt road, an astonishing trail of dust rising behind them. As they passed the ancient burned-out foundation of a house set back among some maple trees, Emily removed her dark glasses and leaned forward, staring. "That is the old Owens place," she said. "He and Dad were friends. He kept a still in his attic and had a big team of dray horses he used to enter in all the fairs. He died with a ruptured appendix when I was about 10 years old. The house burned down a year later at Christmas. They moved to Bremerton after that."
"Is that so?" he said. "Christmas." Then, "Do I turn right or left here? Emily? Right or left?"
"Left," she said. "Left." She put on her glasses again, only to take them off a moment later. "Stay on this road, Harry, until you come to another crossroad, then right. Only a little farther, then." She smoked steadily, one cigarette after the other, was silent now as she looked out at the cleared fields, at the isolated stands of fir trees, at the occasional weathered house. He shifted down, turned right. The road began to drop gradually into a lightly wooded valley. Far ahead, Canada, he supposed. He could see a range of mountains, and behind those mountains, a darker, still higher range. "There's a little road," she said. "At the bottom, that's the road." He turned carefully and drove down the rutted track road slowly, waiting for the first sign of the house. Emily sat next to him, edgy, he could see, smoking again, also waiting for the first glimpse. He blinked his eyes as low, shaggy branches slapped the windshield. She leaned forward slightly and touched her hand to his leg. "Now," she said. He slowed almost to a stop, drove through a tiny clear puddle of a stream that came out of the high grass on his left, then into a mass of dogwood that fingered and scraped the length of the car as the little road climbed. "There it is," she said, moving her hand from his leg. After the first unsettling glance, he kept his eyes on the road. He looked at the house again after he had brought the car to a stop near the front door. Then he licked his lips, turned to her, and tried to smile. "Well, we're here," he said. She was looking at him, not looking at the house at all. Harry had always lived in cities. San Francisco for the last 3 years, and before that, Los Angeles, Chicago, and New York. But for a long time, he had wanted to move to the country, somewhere in the country. At first, he wasn't too clear about where he wanted to go. He just knew he wanted to leave the city to try to start over again. A simpler life was what he had in mind. Just the essentials, he said. He was 32 years old and was a writer in a way, but he was also an actor and a musician. He played the saxophone, performed occasionally with the Bay City Players, and was writing a first novel. He had been writing the novel since the time he lived in New York. One bleak Sunday afternoon in March, when he had again started talking about a change, a more honest life somewhere in the country, she'd mentioned, jokingly at first, her father's deserted place in the northwestern part of Washington. "My God," Harry had said, "you wouldn't mind? Roughing it, I mean. Living in the country like that?" "I was born there," she said, laughing. "Remember? I've lived in the country. It's all right. It has advantages. I could live there again. I don't know about you, though, Harry. If it'd be good for you." She kept looking at him, serious now. He felt lately that she was always looking at him.
"You wouldn't regret it," he said, "giving up things here?"
"I wouldn't be giving up much, would I, Harry?" she shrugged. "But I'm not going to encourage the idea, Harry."
"Could you paint up there?" he asked.
"I can paint anywhere," she said. "And there's Bellingham," she said. "There's a college there. Or else Vancouver or Seattle." She kept watching him. She sat on a stool in front of a shadowy, half-finished portrait of a man and woman and rolled two paintbrushes back and forth in her hand. That was 3 months ago. They had talked about it, and now they were here. He rapped on the walls near the front door.
"Solid. A solid foundation. If you have a solid foundation, that's the main thing."
He avoided looking at her. She was shrewd and might have read something from his eyes. "I told you not to expect too much," she said.
"Yes, you did. I distinctly remember," he said, still not looking at her.
He gave the bare board another rap with his knuckles and moved over beside her. His sleeves were rolled in the damp afternoon heat, and he was wearing white jeans and sandals.
"Quiet, isn't it?"
"A lot different from the city."
"God, yes. Pretty up here, too."
He tried to smile.
"Needs a little work, that's all. A little work. It'll be a good place if we want to stay. Neighbors won't bother us anyway."
"We had neighbors here when I was a little girl," she said. "You had to drive to see them, but they were neighbors." The door opened at an angle. The top hinge was loose. Nothing much, Harry judged. They moved slowly from room to room. He tried to cover his disappointment. Twice he knocked on the walls and said,
"Solid." Or, "They don't make houses like this anymore. You can do a lot with a house like this."
She stopped in front of a large room and drew a long breath.
"Yours?"
She shook her head.
"And we could get the necessary furniture we need from your Aunt Elsie?"
"Yes, whatever we need," she said. "That is, if it's what we want, to stay here. I'm not pushing. It's not too late to go back. There's nothing lost." In the kitchen, they found a wood stove and a mattress pushed against one wall. In the living room again, he looked around and said,
"I thought it'd have a fireplace."
"I never said it had a fireplace."
"I just had the impression for some reason it would have one." "No outlets either," he said a moment later. Then, "No electricity."
"Toilet either," she said. He wet his lips.
"Well," he said, turning away to examine something in the corner, "I guess we could fix up one of these rooms with a tub and all, and get someone to do the plumbing work. But electricity is something else, isn't it? I mean, let's face all these things when we come to them. One thing at a time, right? Don't you think? Let's not let any of it get us down, okay?"
I wish you'd just be quiet, she said. She turned and went outside. He jumped down the steps a minute later and drew a breath of air, and they both lighted cigarettes. A flock of crows got up at the far end of the meadow and flew slowly and silently into the woods. They walked toward the barn, stopping to inspect the withered apple trees. He broke off one of the small dry branches, turned it over and over in his hands while she stood beside him and smoked a cigarette. It was peaceful, more or less appealing country, and he thought it pleasant to feel that something permanent, really permanent, might belong to him. He was taken by a sudden affection for the little orchard.
Get these bearing again, he said. Just need water and some looking after's all.
He could see himself coming out of the house with a wicker basket and pulling down large red apples, still wet with the morning's dew, and he understood that the idea was attractive to him. He felt a little cheered as they approached the barn. He examined briefly the old license plates nailed to the door, green, yellow, white plates from the state of Washington, rusted now, 1922, 23, 24, 25, 26, 27, 28, 29, 34, 36, 37, 40, 41, 1949. He studied the dates as if he thought their sequence might disclose a code. He threw the wooden latch and pulled and pushed at the heavy door until it swung open. The air inside smelled unused, but he believed it was not an unpleasant smell. It rains a lot here in the winter, she said. I don't remember it ever being this hot in June. Sunlight stuck down through the splits in the roof. Once Dad shot a deer out of season. I was about, I don't know, 8 or 9, around in there. She turned to him as he stood, stopped near the door to look at an old harness that hung from a nail. Dad was down here in the barn with the deer when the game warden drove into the yard. It was dark. Mother sent me down here for Dad, and the game warden, a big heavyset man with a hat, followed me. Dad was carrying a lamp, just coming down from the loft. He and the game warden talked a few minutes. The deer was hanging there, but the game warden didn't say anything. He offered Dad a chew of tobacco, but Dad refused. He never had liked it and wouldn't take any, even then. Then the game warden pulled my ear and left. But I don't want to think about any of that, she added quickly. I haven't thought about things like that in years. I don't want to make comparisons, she said. No, she said. She stepped back, shaking her head. I'm not going to cry. I know that sounds melodramatic and just plain stupid, and I'm sorry for sounding melodramatic and stupid. But the truth is, Harry... She shook her head again. I don't know. Maybe coming back here was a mistake. I can feel your disappointment.
You don't know, he said.
No, that's right, I don't know, she said. And I'm sorry, I'm really not meaning to try to influence you one way or the other. But I don't think you want to stay, do you?
He shrugged. He took out a cigarette. She took it from him and held it, waiting for a match, waiting for his eyes to meet hers over the match.
When I was little, she went on, I wanted to be in a circus when I grew up. I didn't want to be a nurse or a teacher or a painter. I didn't want to be a painter then. I wanted to be Emily Horner, high wire artist. It was a big thing with me. I used to practice down here in the barn, walking the rafters. That big rafter up there, I walked that hundreds of times. She started to say something else, but puffed her cigarette and put it out under her heel, tamping it down carefully into the dirt. Outside the barn, he could hear a bird calling. And then he heard a scurrying sound over the boards up in the loft. She walked past him, out into the light, and started slowly through the deep grass toward the house.
What are we going to do, Emily? He called after her.
She stopped, and he came up beside her. Stay alive, she said. Then she shook her head and smiled faintly. She touched his arm.
Jesus, I guess we are in kind of a spot, aren't we?
But that's all I can say, Harry.
We've got to decide, he said,
not really knowing what he meant.
You decide, Harry, if you haven't already. It's your decision. I'd just as soon go back if that makes it any easier for you. We'll stay with Aunt Elsie a day or two and then go back, all right?
But give me a cigarette, will you? I'm going up to the house.
He moved closer to her then and thought they might embrace. He wanted to. But she did not move. She only looked at him steadily. And so he touched her on the nose with his forefinger and said, I'll see you in a little while. He watched her go. He looked at his watch, turned, and walked slowly down the pasture toward the woods. The grass came up to his knees. Just before he entered the woods, as the grass began to thin out, he found a sort of path. He rubbed the bridge of his nose under his dark glasses, looked back at the house and the barn, and continued on slowly. A cloud of mosquitoes moved with his head as he walked. He stopped to light a cigarette. He brushed at the mosquitoes. He looked back again, but now he could not see the house or barn. He stood there smoking, beginning to feel the silence that lay in the grass and in the trees and in the shadows farther back in the trees. Wasn't this what he'd longed for? He walked on, looking for a place to sit. He lighted another cigarette and leaned against a tree. He picked up some wood chips from the soft dirt between his legs. He smoked. He remembered a volume of plays by Gelderoda lying on top of the things in the back seat of the car, and then he recalled some of the little towns they had driven through that morning. Ferndale, Linden, Custer, Nooksack. Note. Visionary Belgian playwright Michel de Gelderoda, 1898 to 1962, whose plays include La Ballade du Grand Macabre, The Ballad of the Great Macabre, 1934, and La Mort du Docteur Faust, The Death of Dr. Faust, 1928. End of note. He suddenly recalled the mattress in the kitchen. He understood that it made him afraid. He tried to imagine Emily walking the big rafter in the barn, but that made him afraid too. He smoked. He felt very calm, really, all things considered. He wasn't going to stay here, he knew that, but it didn't upset him to know that now. He was pleased he knew himself so well. He would be all right, he decided. He was only 32, not so old. He was, for the moment, in a spot. He could admit that. After all, he considered, that was life, wasn't it? He put out the cigarette. In a little while, he lit another one. As he rounded a corner of the house, he saw her completing a cartwheel. She landed with a light thump, slightly crouched, and then she saw him. Hey! She yelled, grinning gravely. She raised herself onto the balls of her feet, arms out to the sides over her head, and then pitched forward. She turned two more cartwheels while he watched, and then she called, How about this? She dropped lightly onto her hands and, getting her balance, began a shaky, hesitant movement in his direction. Face flushed, blouse hanging over her chin, legs waving insanely, she advanced on him.
Have you decided?
She said, quite breathless. He nodded.
So?
She said. She let herself fall against her shoulder and rolled onto her back, covering her eyes from the sun with an arm as if to uncover her breasts. She said, Harry. He was reaching to light a cigarette with his last match when his hands began to tremble. The match went out, and he stood there holding the empty matchbook and the cigarette, staring at the vast expanse of trees at the end of the bright meadow.
Harry, we have to love each other, she said. We'll just have to love each other, she said.
Bicycles, muscles, cigarettes. It had been 2 days since Evan Hamilton had stopped smoking,
and it seemed to him everything he'd said and thought for the 2 days somehow suggested cigarettes. He looked at his hands under the kitchen light. He sniffed his knuckles and his fingers. "I can smell it," he said. "I know. It's as if it sweats out of you," Ann Hamilton said. "For 3 days after I stopped, I could smell it on me. Even when I got out of the bath, it was disgusting." She was putting plates on the table for dinner. "I'm so sorry, dear. I know what you're going through. But if it's any consolation, the second day is always the hardest." "The third day is hard too, of course, but from then on, if you can stay with it that long, you're over the hump." "But I'm so happy you're serious about quitting. I can't tell you." She touched his arm. "Now if you'll just call Roger, we'll eat." Hamilton opened the front door. It was already dark. It was early in November and the days were short and cool. An older boy he had never seen before was sitting on a small, well-equipped bicycle in the driveway. The boy leaned forward just off the seat, the toes of his shoes touching the pavement and keeping him upright.
"You Mr. Hamilton?" the boy said.
"Yes, I am," Hamilton said. "What is it? Is it Roger?"
"I guess Roger is down at my house talking to my mother. Kip is there and this boy named Gary Berman. It is about my brother's bike. I don't know for sure," the boy said, twisting the handle grips. "But my mother asked me to come and get you, one of Roger's parents."
"But he's all right," Hamilton said. "Yes, of course, I'll be right with you."
He went into the house to put his shoes on.
"Did you find him?" Ann Hamilton said.
"He's in some kind of jam," Hamilton answered. "Over a bicycle. Some boy, I didn't catch his name, is outside. He wants one of us to go back with him to his house."
"Is he all right?"
Ann Hamilton said and took her apron off.
"Sure, he's all right."
Hamilton looked at her and shook his head.
"It sounds like it's just a childish argument and the boy's mother is getting herself involved."
"Do you want me to go?"
Ann Hamilton asked. He thought for a minute.
"Yes, I'd rather you went, but I'll go. Just hold dinner until we're back. We shouldn't be long."
"I don't like his being out after dark," Ann Hamilton said. "I don't like it."
The boy was sitting on his bicycle and working the handbrake now.
"How far?"
Hamilton said as they started down the sidewalk.
"Over in Arbuckle Court," the boy answered.
And when Hamilton looked at him, the boy added,
"Not far, about 2 blocks from here."
"What seems to be the trouble?" Hamilton asked.
"I don't know for sure. I don't understand all of it. He and Kip and this Gary Berman are supposed to have used my brother's bike while we were on vacation, and I guess they wrecked it. On purpose. But I don't know. Anyway, that's what they're talking about. My brother can't find his bike, and they had it last, Kip and Roger. My mom is trying to find out where it's at."
"I know Kip," Hamilton said. "Who's this other boy?"
"Gary Berman. I guess he's new in the neighborhood. His dad is coming as soon as he gets home."
They turned a corner. The boy pushed himself along, keeping just slightly ahead. Hamilton saw an orchard, and then they turned another corner onto a dead-end street. He hadn't known of the existence of this street and was sure he would not recognize any of the people who lived here. He looked around him at the unfamiliar houses and was struck with the range of his son's personal life. The boy turned into a driveway and got off the bicycle and leaned it against the house. When the boy opened the front door, Hamilton followed him through the living room and into the kitchen, where he saw his son sitting on one side of a table, along with Kip Hollister and another boy. Hamilton looked closely at Roger, and then he turned to the stout, dark-haired woman at the head of the table.
"You're Roger's father?"
the woman said to him.
"Yes, my name is Evan Hamilton. Good evening."
"I'm Mrs. Miller, Gilbert's mother," she said. "Sorry to ask you over here, but we have a problem."
Hamilton sat down in a chair at the other end of the table and looked around. A boy of 9 or 10, the boy whose bicycle was missing, Hamilton supposed, sat next to the woman. Another boy, 14 or so, sat on the draining board, legs dangling, and watched another boy who was talking on the telephone.
Grinning slyly at something that had just been said to him over the line, the boy reached over to the sink with a cigarette. Hamilton heard the sound of the cigarette sputting out in a glass of water. The boy who had brought him leaned against the refrigerator and crossed his arms.
"Did you get one of Kip's parents?" the woman said to the boy.
"His sister said they were shopping. I went to Gary Berman's and his father will be here in a few minutes. I left the address."
"Mr. Hamilton," the woman said, "I'll tell you what happened. We were on vacation last month and Kip wanted to borrow Gilbert's bike so that Roger could help him with Kip's paper route. I guess Roger's bike had a flat tire or something. Well, as it turns out..."
"Gary was joking me, Dad," Roger said.
"What?" Hamilton said, looking at his son carefully.
"He was choking me. I got the marks."
His son pulled down the collar of his t-shirt to show his neck. "They were out in the garage," the woman continued. "I didn't know what they were doing until Kurt, my oldest, went out to see."
"He started it," Gary Berman said to Hamilton. "He called me a jerk."
Gary Berman looked toward the front door. "I think my bike cost about $60, you guys," the boy named Gilbert said. "You can pay me for it."
"You keep out of this, Gilbert," the woman said to him.
Hamilton took a breath.
"Go on,"
he said. "Well, as it turns out, Kip and Roger used Gilbert's bike to help Kip deliver his papers, and then the two of them, and Gary too, they say, took turns rolling it."
"What do you mean, rolling it?" Hamilton said.
"Rolling it," the woman said. "Sending it down the street with a push and letting it fall over. Then, mind you, and they just admitted this a few minutes ago, Kip and Roger took it up to the school and threw it against a goalpost."
"Is that true, Roger?" Hamilton said, looking at his son again.
"Part of it's true, Dad," Roger said, looking down and rubbing his finger over the table. "But we only rolled it once. Kip did it, then Gary, and then I did it."
"Once is too much," Hamilton said. "Once is one too many times, Roger. I'm surprised and disappointed in you. And you too, Kip," Hamilton said.
"But you see," the woman said, "someone's fibbing tonight, or else not telling all he knows, for the fact is the bike's still missing."
The older boys in the kitchen laughed and kidded with the boy who still talked on the telephone.
"We don't know where the bike is, Mrs. Miller," the boy named Kip said. "We told you already. The last time we saw it was when me and Roger took it to my house after we had it at school. I mean, that was the next to last time. The very last time was when I took it back here the next morning and parked it behind the house."
He shook his head.
"We don't know where it is," the boy said.
$60, the boy named Gilbert said to the boy named Kip. "You can pay me off, like $5 a week."
"Gilbert, I'm warning you," the woman said. "You see, they claim," the woman went on, frowning now, "it disappeared from here, from behind the house. But how can we believe them when they haven't been all that truthful this evening?"
"We've told the truth," Roger said. "Everything."
Gilbert leaned back in his chair and shook his head at Hamilton's son. The doorbell sounded, and the boy on the draining board jumped down and went into the living room. A stiff-shouldered man with a crew haircut and sharp gray eyes entered the kitchen without speaking. He glanced at the woman and moved over behind Gary Berman's chair.
"You must be Mr. Berman," the woman said. "Happy to meet you. I'm Gilbert's mother, and this is Mr. Hamilton, Roger's father."
The man inclined his head at Hamilton, but did not offer his hand.
"What's all this about?"
Berman said to his son. The boys at the table began to speak at once.
"Quiet down," Berman said. "I'm talking to Gary. You'll get your turn."
The boy began his account of the affair. His father listened closely, now and then narrowing his eyes to study the other two boys. When Gary Berman had finished, the woman said,
"I'd like to get to the bottom of this. I'm not accusing any one of them, you understand, Mr. Hamilton, Mr. Berman. I'd just like to get to the bottom of this."
She looked steadily at Roger and Kip,
who were shaking their heads at Gary Berman.
It's not true, Gary, Roger said. Dad, can I talk to you in private?
Gary Berman said.
Let's go,
the man said, and they walked into the living room. Hamilton watched them go. He had the feeling he should stop them, this secrecy. His palms were wet, and he reached to his shirt pocket for a cigarette. Then, breathing deeply, he passed the back of his hand under his nose and said,
Roger, do you know any more about this, other than what you've already said? Do you know where Gilbert's bike is?
No, I don't, the boy said. I swear it.
When was the last time you saw the bicycle?
Hamilton said.
When we brought it home from school and left it at Kip's house.
Kip, Hamilton said, do you know where Gilbert's bicycle is now?
I swear I don't either, the boy answered. I brought it back the next morning after we had it at school and I parked it behind the garage.
I thought you said you left it behind the house, the woman said quickly.
I mean the house, that's what I meant, the boy said.
Did you come back here some other day to ride it? She asked, leaning forward.
No, I didn't, Kip answered.
Kip? She said.
I didn't. I don't know where it is, the boy shouted.
The woman raised her shoulders and let them drop.
How do you know who or what to believe? She said to Hamilton. All I know is Gilbert's missing a bicycle.
Gary Berman and his father returned to the kitchen.
It was Roger's idea to roll it,
Gary Berman said.
It was yours, Roger said, coming out of his chair. You wanted to. Then you wanted to take it to the orchard and strip it.
You shut up, Berman said to Roger. You can speak when spoken to, young man, not before. Gary, I'll handle this. Dragged out at night because of a couple of roughnecks. Now if either of you,
Berman said, looking first at Kip and then Roger,
know where this kid's bicycle is, I'd advise you to start talking.
I think you're getting out of line, Hamilton said.
What?
Berman said, his forehead darkening.
And I think you'd do better to mind your own business.
Let's go, Roger, Hamilton said, standing up. Kip, you come now or stay.
He turned to the woman.
I don't know what else we can do tonight. I intend to talk this over more with Roger, but if there is a question of restitution, I feel since Roger did help manhandle the bike, he can pay a third if it comes to that.
I don't know what to say, the woman replied, following Hamilton through the living room. I'll talk to Gilbert's father. He's out of town now. We'll see. It's probably one of those things finally, but I'll talk to his father.
Hamilton moved to one side so that the boys could pass ahead of him onto the porch. And from behind him, he heard Gary Berman say,
He called me a jerk, Dad.
Did he? Did he?
Hamilton heard Berman say,
Well, he's the jerk. He looks like a jerk.
Hamilton turned and said,
I think you're seriously out of line here tonight, Mr. Berman. Why don't you get control of yourself?
And I told you I think you should keep out of it, Berman said.
You get home, Roger. Hamilton said, moistening his lips. I mean it, he said. Get going.
Roger and Kip moved out to the sidewalk. Hamilton stood in the doorway and looked at Berman, who was crossing the living room with his son.
Mr. Hamilton?
The woman began nervously, but did not finish.
What do you want?
Berman said to him.
Watch out now. Get out of my way.
Berman brushed Hamilton's shoulder and Hamilton stepped off the porch into some prickly, cracking bushes. He couldn't believe it was happening. He moved out of the bushes and lunged at the man where he stood on the porch. They fell heavily onto the lawn. They rolled on the lawn, Hamilton wrestling Berman onto his back and coming down hard with his knees on the man's biceps. He had Berman by the collar now and began to pound his head against the lawn while the woman cried,
God almighty, someone stop them! For God's sake, someone call the police!
Hamilton stopped. Berman looked up at him and said,
Get off me.
Are you all right?
The woman called to the men as they separated.
For God's sake, she said.
She looked at the men, who stood a few feet apart, backs to each other, breathing hard. The older boys had crowded onto the porch to watch. Now that it was over, they waited, watching the men, and then they began fainting and punching each other on the arms and ribs.
You boys get back in the house,
the woman said. I never thought I'd see, she said and put her hand on her breast. Hamilton was sweating and his lungs burned when he tried to take a deep breath. There was a ball of something in his throat so that he couldn't swallow for a minute. He started walking, his son and the boy named Kip at his sides. He heard car doors slam, an engine start. Headlights swept over him as he walked. Rogers sobbed once, and Hamilton put his arm around the boy's shoulders.
I better get home, Kip said and began to cry. My dad'll be looking for me.
And the boy ran.
I'm sorry, Hamilton said. I'm sorry you had to see something like that, Hamilton said to his son.
They kept walking, and when they reached their block, Hamilton took his arm away.
What if he'd picked up a knife, Dad, or a club?
He wouldn't have done anything like that, Hamilton said.
But what if he had, his son said.
It's hard to say what people will do when they're angry, Hamilton said.
They started up the walk to their door. His heart moved when Hamilton saw the lighted windows.
Let me feel your muscle, his son said.
Not now, Hamilton said. You just go in now and have your dinner and hurry up to bed. Tell your mother I'm all right and I'm going to sit on the porch for a few minutes.
The boy rocked from one foot to the other and looked at his father, and then he dashed into the house and began calling,
Mom! Mom!
He sat on the porch and leaned against the garage wall and stretched his legs. The sweat had dried on his forehead. He felt clammy under his clothes. He had once seen his father, a pale, slow-talking man with slumped shoulders, in something like this. It was a bad one, and both men had been hurt. It had happened in a cafe. The other man was a farmhand. Hamilton had loved his father and could recall many things about him, but now he recalled his father's one fist fight as if it were all there was to the man. He was still sitting on the porch when his wife came out.
Dear God, she said and took his head in her hands. Come in and shower and then have something to eat and tell me about it. Everything is still warm. Roger has gone to bed.
But he heard his son calling him. He's still awake, she said.
I'll be down in a minute, Hamilton said. Then maybe we should have a drink.
She shook her head. I really don't believe any of this yet. He went into the boy's room and sat down at the foot of the bed.
It's pretty late and you're still up, so I'll say goodnight, Hamilton said.
Goodnight, the boy said, hands behind his neck, elbows jutting. He was in his pajamas and had a warm, fresh smell about him that Hamilton breathed deeply. He patted his son through the covers.
You take it easy from now on. Stay away from that part of the neighborhood, and don't let me ever hear of you damaging a bicycle or any other personal property. Is that clear?
Hamilton said. The boy nodded. He took his hands from behind his neck and began picking at something on the bedspread.
Okay, then, Hamilton said. I'll say goodnight.
He moved to kiss his son, but the boy began talking.
Dad, was Grandfather strong like you? When he was your age, I mean, you know, and you...
And I was 9 years old, is that what you mean?
Yes, I guess he was, Hamilton said.
Sometimes I can hardly remember him, the boy said. I don't want to forget him or anything, you know? You know what I mean, Dad?
When Hamilton did not answer at once, the boy went on.
When you were young, was it like it is with you and me? Did you love him more than me, or just the same?
The boy said this abruptly. He moved his feet under the covers and looked away. When Hamilton still did not answer, the boy said,
Did he smoke? I think I remember a pipe or something.
He started smoking a pipe before he died, that's true,
Hamilton said.
He used to smoke cigarettes a long time ago, and then he'd get depressed with something or other and quit. But later he'd change brands and start in again. Let me show you something, Hamilton said. Smell the back of my hand.
The boy took the hand in his, sniffed it, and said,
I guess I don't smell anything, Dad.
What is it?
Hamilton sniffed the hand and then the fingers.
Now I can't smell anything either, he said. It was there before, but now it's gone.
Maybe it was scared out of me, he thought.
I wanted to show you something. All right, it's late now. You better go to sleep, Hamilton said.
The boy rolled onto his side and watched his father walk to the door and watched him put his hand to the switch. And then the boy said, Dad, you'll think I'm pretty crazy, but I wish I'd known you when you were little. I mean, about as old as I am right now. I don't know how to say it, but I'm lonesome about it. It's like I miss you already if I think about it now.
That's pretty crazy, isn't it?
Anyway, please leave the door open. Hamilton left the door open, and then he thought better of it and closed it halfway.
What is it? Fact is, the car needs to be sold in a hurry, and Leo sends Tony out to do it. Tony is smart and has personality. She used to sell children's encyclopedias door to door. She signed him up, even though he didn't have kids. Afterward, Leo asked her for a date, and the date led to this. This deal has to be cash, and it has to be done tonight. Tomorrow, somebody they owe might slap a lien on the car. Monday, they'll be in court, home free. But word on them went out yesterday when their lawyer mailed the letters of intention. The hearing on Monday is nothing to worry about, the lawyer has said. They'll be asked some questions, and they'll sign some papers, and that's it. But sell the convertible, he said, today, tonight. They can hold on to the little car, Leo's car, no problem. But they go into court with that big convertible, the court will take it, and that's that. Tony dresses up. It's 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Leo worries the lots will close, but Tony takes her time dressing. She puts on a new white blouse, wide lacy cuffs, the new two-piece suit, new heels. She transfers the stuff from her straw purse into the new patent leather handbag. She studies the lizard makeup pouch and puts that in, too. Tony has been 2 hours on her hair and face. Leo stands in the bedroom doorway and taps his lips with his knuckles, watching.
You're making me nervous, she says. I wish you wouldn't just stand, she says. So tell me how I look.
You look fine, he says. You look great. I'd buy a car from you anytime.
But you don't have money, she says, peering into the mirror. She pats her hair, frowns. And your credit's lousy. You're nothing, she says. Teasing, she says, and looks at him in the mirror. Don't be serious, she says. It has to be done, so I'll do it. You take it out. You'd be lucky to get $300-$400, and we both know it. Honey, you'd be lucky if you didn't have to pay them.
She gives her hair a final pat, gums her lips, blots the lipstick with a tissue. She turns away from the mirror and picks up her purse.
I'll have to have dinner or something. I told you that already. That's the way they work. I know them. But don't worry, I'll get out of it, she says. I can handle it.
Jesus, Leo says. Did you have to say that?
She looks at him steadily. Wish me luck, she says.
Luck, he says. You have the pink slip, he says.
She nods. He follows her through the house. A tall woman with a small high bust, broad hips and thighs. He scratches a pimple on his neck.
You're sure? He says. Make sure. You have to have the pink slip.
I have the pink slip, she says.
Make sure.
She starts to say something, instead looks at herself in the front window and then shakes her head.
At least call, he says. Let me know what's going on.
I'll call, she says. Kiss, kiss.
Here, she says, and points to the corner of her mouth.
Careful, she says.
He holds the door for her.
Where are you going to try first? He says.
She moves past him and onto the porch. Ernest Williams looks from across the street. In his Bermuda shorts, stomach hanging, He looks at Leo and Tony as he directs a spray onto his begonias. Once, last winter, during the holidays when Tony and the kids were visiting his mother's, Leo brought a woman home. 9 o'clock the next morning, a cold, foggy Saturday, Leo walked the woman to the car, surprised Ernest Williams on the sidewalk with a newspaper in his hand. Fog drifted. Ernest Williams stared, then slapped the paper against his leg, hard. Leo recalls that slap, hunches his shoulders, says,
"You have someplace in mind first?"
"I'll just go down the line," she says. "The first lot, then I'll just go down the line."
"Open at 900, he says, "then come down. 900 is low blue book, even on a cash deal."
"I know where to start," she says.
Ernest Williams turns the hose in their direction. He stares at them through the spray of water. Leo has an urge to cry out a confession.
"Just making sure," he says.
"Okay, okay," she says. "I'm off."
It's her car. They call it her car, and that makes it all the worse. They bought it new that summer, 3 years ago. She wanted something to do after the kids started school, so she went back selling. He was working 6 days a week in the fiberglass plant. For a while, they didn't know how to spend the money. Then they put $1,000 on the convertible and doubled and tripled the payments until in a year they had it paid. Earlier, while she was dressing, he took the jack and spare from the trunk and emptied the glove compartment of pencils, matchbooks, blue chip stamps.
Note:
trading stamps given away with purchases at supermarkets and gas stations. Redeemable for merchandise. End of note. Then he washed it and vacuumed inside. The red hood and fenders shine.
"Good luck,"
he says and touches her elbow. She nods. He sees she is already gone, already negotiating.
"Things are going to be different,"